I think that all of us have these very deep feelings of tenderness.
You get stronger as you become more open.
If I can be vulnerable, that'll help other people be vulnerable.
And it doesn't work for me to be silent.
I can't believe I'm going to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell you this story.
This is the first time that I've told aloud.
If I could have known that you and I were alike, I would have had so much more hope.
Listening to other people's stories, you realize,
wow, these people are all experiencing the same thing that we are.
You are not the only one.
Welcome to Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on shame and trauma in the medical encounter. At the end of this show, please go back to our website to answer a few questions that will help reinforce some of the important clinical takeaways. Your feedback will also help us learn more about the value of hearing our patients as teachers.
Dr. Lazar was a psychiatrist, the chancellor of UMass Medical School, and the author of 6 books, including my favorite, which is called On Apologies. I first met him when I was still a medical student. I heard him give a lecture on shame in the medical encounter. He was the first person to teach me about the importance of shame in the interaction between the doctor and the patient, how difficult shame makes it for patients to reveal what feels wrong with them, and how it can stand in the way of them getting the treatment they need. His work was an important inspiration for Safe Space Radio, which is all about reducing shame by discussing the feelings and experiences that we hide. He was an extraordinary teacher, and I'm so glad to have had this conversation with him. Here's my conversation with Dr. Aaron Lazar, which first aired in June 2010. Welcome to Safe Space, Aaron Lazar.
Glad to be with you.
I want to start out by asking you how you first got interested in the topic of shame.
I was very sensitive to patients' experiences, and I saw how patients were ashamed of so many things. And I learned about this from myself because I'm a patient and everyone else is. And so I was just watching myself and thinking of the devious things we do to avoid being shamed, like when you go to the dentist for your checkups. I noticed that I brush my teeth more religiously for the 2 weeks before I come.
Right.
And if I haven't, sometimes I cancel the appointment, so I don't. So the dentist says, "My God, what a terrible person you've been."
Yeah, and you always wonder, if I just floss for those last 2 weeks before the appointment, will they know?
Right,
will I be able to cover it up?
I found out that you can in 2 weeks you can make yourself look pretty good. But there's so many things, you know, in medicine, you have to take off your clothes. And if, God forbid, you're hospitalized, they put you in a gown. How shameful it is, because shame has to do with losing the image that you have of yourself, things that make you proud, and here you're denuded. And then they give you names of diseases that are really shameful.
Like what would be some examples
of
that?
Even the simplest thing, like hypertension. Hypertension refers to high blood pressure. It doesn't mean that you're tense, but it also has a stigma of being tense. In having a heart attack, you know, there's a you can have an inferior infarction, which refers to a blood vessel that's called the inferior coronary artery. I had a patient one who I said, "You have an inferior infarction," and he said, "No, this is a big one. I had a superior infarction." But through every kind of diseases, we shame and humiliate people. You have heart failure. What an awful thing to say to somebody. Or you have an incompetent cervix. That's a legitimate diagnosis.
Yes.
Something about the anatomy of the cervix, but call it incompetent. What an awful thing.
Right, so the person can't help but feel like somehow it's my fault.
Yeah, you have a lazy eye or a failed back, or even you're an invalid. Invalid, that's invalid. So doctors really don't put themselves in the patient's position, but that's something that I always did. And so I try to make these changes to preserve the dignity of a patient, because medical care has so many indignities associated with it.
Yes, you know, part of it, I feel very grateful to have this chance to interview you, because you really opened my eyes to that, I think, when I was in the first year of medical school. And it ended up having a very powerful effect on me all the way through, because I kept thinking about that and noticing it and how painful that was.
How about having a malignancy? It's bad enough you have cancer, but
Right. Malignant. It sounds so evil.
That's right. Yeah, there's something evil about you.
Yes. So actually, maybe it would be good to backtrack a little bit and define our terms. You've spoken about there being four self-conscious emotions, and I think it might be worth us actually taking some time to go through each one and
sure.
how they're different.
There are four emotions that are called the emotions of self-assessment, that an emotion you feel which reflects on who you are, and one of the four is shame. And the word shame comes from skema, to cover. So to be shamed is to be uncovered. Humiliation is actually a more painful emotion because it comes from the humus, the dirt. It means to have your face pushed into the ground. And to be humiliated, in general, it means it's an interpersonal event. Someone does it to you, it feels unfair, and you're lowered. And it's public, and with shame, the reaction to shame is to hide. But humiliation generates anger and rage, and a lot of people who commit murders or who are violent have just been humiliated. So that's really a very serious emotion, and one that I pay a lot of attention to because it's so powerful. Another one is embarrassment, which is the least serious, but to be embarrassed is to lose your composure. So when you're embarrassed, you tend to laugh it off or you tell your friend, which is a healthy way to deal with it. With humiliation, you just can't get it off your mind. It's driving you crazy. You perseverate with it, and to shame, you hide. And then guilt is, again, a more quiet one. How could I have done something so terrible? And that's usually a private emotion, too. So these are called signal emotions, which means that they signal that you have a problem. And so if you're embarrassed, what you ought to do is say, I've lost composure. How do I gain my composure instead of doing something really stupid? Or to be humiliated, what you should do is nothing because your judgment is so bad. For those of you who have been humiliated, anyone who has not been, I'm afraid to say that you're a liar.
Either that or they repressed it because it's such a horrible experience.
It's horrible.
Yes.
Humiliation is the cause of wars. In fact, people about 5th century B.C., someone who wrote the history of the Peloponnesian Wars said that the three causes of war are greed, fear, and loss of honor. And loss of honor is what humiliation is all about.
Yes, I mean, I remember being told in high school that World War II, in some ways, was the result of Germany being humiliated after World War I.
That's common historical knowledge, that the Versailles Treaty was so cruel that they had to get even. And so Hitler rose to power because Hitler was a humiliated person, and now he was going to lead and get redeemed by it. Yeah, yeah.
It's
humiliation is a dangerous, dangerous emotion, and you should never humiliate someone. And when you do and you can't help it, a good apology can help it. And if it happens to yourself, as I said, don't do anything because you're going to do something really dumb. If you write a letter, don't
send
mail
it.
Shame and humiliation are unfortunately common in everyday medical encounters. Healthcare providers are often unaware of how vulnerable our patients feel at having their problems exposed, and we may not know the best way to acknowledge and address this. Similarly, trauma resulting from medical experiences has only recently been recognized as a source of PTSD for patients long after they leave the hospital. My next guest, Dr. Nancy Kasem Adams, speaks with me about post-traumatic stress reactions in children after life-threatening illness, injury, or painful medical procedures.
Dr. Nancy Kasem Adams is a psychologist and is Associate Director for Behavioral Research at the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's also Associate Research Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. Since 1998, her research has focused on post-traumatic stress in ill and injured children and their parents. She currently heads an international project to develop better prediction tools for PTSD after acute child trauma. Dr. Kasem Adams also co-directs the Center for Pediatric Traumatic Stress, an intervention development center in the U.S. National Child Traumatic Stress Network. Welcome to Safe Space, Nancy.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let's start by talking about the whole idea of pediatric medical trauma. We tend, I think, in our culture to think of trauma as something associated with returned vets, with rape or child abuse. We don't immediately, or even natural disasters, we don't tend to think of trauma as something that happens to sick children. And I'd love to hear from you how you began to realize that medical trauma was, in fact, a large source of trauma for kids.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we're used to thinking about what kids might need if there's been a natural disaster or a catastrophe or something that affects the whole community, or it's just very visible and obvious to the world. And when the child has a cancer diagnosis or there's a car crash, I mean, one of the ways we think of that is kind of this private individual catastrophe. I mean, suddenly for that child and family, at least, the world has changed and it's a very different place. And I think that working in a pediatric hospital, we have lots of chances to see those, you know, individual catastrophes unfolding day after day for the patients that we see.
And maybe is there just an example of a story that you could tell me that just kind of helps me get a feel for that?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking in particular of one 8-year-old little boy who was just having a normal day, doing what kids do, riding on his bicycle in the park with a friend. The friend's kind of on the back of the bike and jumps off, you know, what 8- and 9-year-old boys will do. Mm-hmm. And the bike shoots into the street, and this little boy, who ends up as our patient, is hit by a car, and the car drives away.
Oh.
And so you can imagine the scene, the mother getting the call, she's not there at the time. She later talked about her terror hearing that her child had been hurt. Luckily, she's able to be in the ambulance with him. One of the things we often will ask parents is kind of, and kids, in the course of our research, trying to understand their experiences, what was the worst part of this for you, and then what's helped to make it better. And interesting, for the child, the worst part was waking up in the hospital in the middle of the night, one of those later days. It wasn't actually the accident itself.
Waking up and finding that he was alone?
Waking up alone in the middle of the night in the hospital room, yeah.
Yeah.
And for the mom, the worst part was actually kind of understanding that this car had driven away, that someone had hurt her child and driven away. And so, I guess...
Kind of shatters your sense of human beings.
Yeah, it shatters your sense of safety. And it also kind of points out that we don't always know what will be the hardest part for any particular child or family member, and we really have to ask to know that. It might not be what we'd expect. And that might be very different for the parent and the child or for anyone else in the family.
It makes sense to me. One of the things about trauma, I think, always, is that it shatters our sense of the world is safe, but even about sort of human nature.
Yeah,
this can
absolutely
happen.
And this is that's a particular instance of a human being involved. In a lot of medical trauma, that's not the case. But yeah, the particular thing that is hard for this person to deal with may be anything about it. You know, for parents of kids with cancer, it may be the really understanding the life threat. Actually, some of my colleague Ann Kazak's research has shown that for parents, it's a lot more about the life threat and understanding that the big problems that come with cancer. And for kids, often it's getting those painful procedures or losing your hair, the much more immediate kind of thing. So it can be, there's developmental parts of what this experience is like for a 3-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 12-year-old, maybe quite different. There's things about whether you're the person it's happening to, the patient, or whether you're someone in their family.
Yes.
But it can certainly be hard for, not just for the patient, for their entire family.
Yeah, so, and one of the things that strikes me is, so the experience, while everybody's focused on the experience of this accident, if we just stay with this example, mm-hmm. their experience of it is so very different that people are having very different experiences of the same thing.
Yep.
And I can imagine, is it for you as someone trying to intervene and help, is it sometimes a challenge in your work to realize that people may be responding very differently or having very different experiences of the same thing?
Well, I think it's a lesson that mental health professionals and healthcare providers, I mean, as the professionals, I think the message is the one we have in a lot of cases, not specific to trauma, is we need to ask and then listen and find out. You know, it's also true that most families, you know, even hearing that experience, terrifying as it is, it's most likely that this child and his parent will do well. eventually. You know, most families do, with some support, with support of the professionals around them, but certainly with their own coping strategies and families kind of pulling together in crisis. You know, again, going with research stats, about 80% of families and kids will do fine 6 months later. But there's a significant minority, maybe 15 to 20% or so, who will still be struggling 6 months later. And so when we are seeing folks in those early days, we want to be cognizant that these changes might be happening, that they might be having some traumatic stress responses, that there might be really difficult and terrifying things going on, and do what we can to deal with that. But we don't want to see this as, let's say, PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder when folks are scared in the early days and weeks after something.
And so if we think about that, if we think sort of with this 15 to 20% of families that where there might be ongoing difficulty, what does that look like? What if someone, you know, if I was a parent with a child who'd had some very difficult medical experience, what would I be on the lookout for?
Well, thinking about this, the same family that we were talking about earlier, when we talked with this little boy 6 months later, he tells us that he's having bad dreams, that there was a time when he saw his cat almost get hit by a car, or he thought that might happen, and he kind of froze, that he's sleeping with his teddy bear again, even though he's eight and had stopped doing that. So I think that there can be things that might be very obvious to parents. You may be aware that your child's having bad dreams, or they may not be so obvious. So the challenge as a parent is to kind of stay in touch with what's happening with your child. Again, not to pathologize or see every little response as a sign of big trouble, but to just be aware of how a child is doing and look for changes in behavior, look for a child who's still upset or jumpy or worried, even though it's been more than a month, changes in school.
Right, so you're looking...
Kind of not interested in doing stuff they used to want to do.
Right, so what I'm hearing is in some ways is it's less direct than it might be with an adult, say. It's not the child saying, you know, mommy, I'm still afraid about this. It's really noticing changes in behavior that are clues.
I think it is. And I think taking the time to ask, at least occasionally, not to grill your child regularly about how they're doing,
right,
but taking the time to ask and listen and to talk very, you know, following your child's lead, but being open to talking about what happened. I think that kids often also want to kind of protect their parents, so they may not just come up and say, I'm really upset, because often they see that parents are still upset as well, and they don't want to add to that. And it's a really hard thing to know what's going on inside someone else, even your own child. So it's a hard job. We have often found that parents and children don't agree very well when we ask them about how children are doing. So when we look at the research data, we see that parents often kind of assume that their child must be responding the way they are. The data also tell us that that's probably not a very good bet. But I completely understand as a parent how hard it is to know what's going on inside my child and how I might kind of figure that probably they're responding like I do.
And
so being open to thinking that their response might be different than mine.
And is there any pattern in that? Like, is it usual that one of them is actually having a hard time than the other, or is there no real pattern to it?
I don't know that there's really a pattern. There's a, you know, certainly it's a little more likely if one person's having a hard time that the other one is as well. But it's very common for it to be just one or the other family member and not both.
It's very poignant for me to hear you say that the child is often protecting the parent.
Mm-hmm.
It's very touching. You know, here's this child who may be suffering some very painful illness, and they're so concerned to take care of their parents.
Mm-hmm. And they see that other people are, I mean, it depends, of course, on the situation, but when they see that their parent is worried or upset, they often don't want to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
So as professionals, we certainly want to talk with parents and children together, but we want to have a little bit of time where we're talking just with the child and really listening to hear their experience without their parent there, so that they're not, not to keep a secret from the parent, but so that they're not minimizing what they're feeling in order, you know, sort of in front of their parent.
Yes. So I want to talk a little bit now about the child's experience specifically. You said that parents often are focused on the sort of the threat of loss of life of the child, which makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And you said the child is often focused on the really painful procedures they have to go through. And I'd love to hear about how pediatric practice is evolving. I know that you're very involved in initiatives that are you know, spreading the word throughout medical centers in the country about this. But I even recall, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, Nancy, but my memory in medical school was learning that historically it was thought that young children didn't yet feel pain. Is there some legacy in medical practice around sort of...
I think we're getting a lot better at pain. Not perfect, obviously. And that certainly is a risk factor for post-traumatic stress, and so it's something that we really welcome when we think about, you know, trauma-informed care or care, pediatric care that keeps traumatic stress in mind, really optimizing pain management, making sure that we're doing everything we can to control kids' pain is a piece of that.
Yeah.
I think that we're doing a lot better at pain management. I mean, one of the reasons, and this is a great one for adults and for kids, is that the organization that accredits hospitals now requires lots of good documentation and excellence in practice in pain management. So JCO requirements include that. And so often when there's policies like that, it makes everyone sort of get their game better. And so
yes,
people are doing a lot better at that. They talk about pain as the fifth vital sign. Other movement that I think is very congruent with trauma-informed care is the movement toward family-centered care and really involving families, and for kids that mostly means parents, involving them in understanding what's going on in the care itself where possible, giving as much control as possible to patients and families. That certainly helps a lot with for both for the parent's own response and also for the child to have their parent there and present for as much of medical procedures as possible.
I know. I remember hearing of a NICU, a neonatal intensive care unit in New Hampshire, where they actually, every little isolette for the newborn has a bed beside it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the only one in the northern New England states that has that. But I think about my friends who've had babies in the NICU, how just terrible it's been. And there's been nowhere there for them to sleep or stay mm-hmm. overnight. And so this movement towards family care, it feels like it's maybe early, but it has a capacity to make such a difference.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of movement, and I think there's a growing comfort. We're not all the way there yet, and it varies a lot probably based on whether you're in a child-centered or a pediatric hospital or a large community hospital that's treating children and adults. But there's certainly, in general, of movement toward parent presence during procedures, parent presence in the ambulance. You know, and it's a complex issue in some ways. In general, the default should be that parents are present, but not every parent can handle it. I think we also need to give parents permission to say, this is just not something I can do. I think I'm going to freak out and make it worse for my child. And then the professionals can step up and support that child or find another adult in the family who maybe can handle it. I also think it behooves the professionals around there and think of the timing, particularly in an emergency room, where you've got to act quickly. And we want them to do everything they can to do the medical procedures. But if in the course of that they can give the parent something to do and give some quick instruction, you know, sit here, hold her hand, have her look in your eyes, and you do that, and we'll be over here. Some quick instruction can really make a difference, because we want parents present, but we want them present in a way that's not traumatizing to them, to the parent, and that's helpful to the child. And we know that distraction is a great idea. And
yes,
there's research actually showing, this probably goes against some of the things I did as a parent when my children were small, but that lots of reassurance from a parent during a painful procedure probably increases the child's pain. And what do we want to do as a mom? You want to say, oh, it's going to be okay. But best practice really is to just be distracting during an immediate painful procedure.
So interesting. Okay. Let's talk about that, because that's sort of counterintuitive. So
yeah,
the parent reassuring the child is going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. There's some research to suggest that, yeah, it's pretty consistent findings that lots of emotional reassuring. And, you know, we're speculating as to why, but it might be that it sends a message that this is something to worry about.
Right, because why would you be reassuring me so much unless you were worrying?
That's right. But perhaps it's even an easier job, and it's just to be very strong. Your child's going through this. Do something to distract them. Do it, you know, depending on what's happening and where on the child's body. You know, talk about something else. Play that video game.
Yes.
Just be distracting.
And, you know, that's the thing that struck me in reading some of the research papers that you've written. I was struck by the in some ways it almost seemed like a conflict between reports of what put a child at risk for traumatic symptoms seemed to be the separation from a parent during a procedure,
mm-hmm.
But conversely, what seemed to put a parent at risk for acute stress symptoms was being present for all these procedures.
I think for parents, it's a double-edged sword. I think most of us would want to be there for two reasons. If it helps our child, then even if it's stressful for us, we'll deal with that. And then the second reason is that, it, hard as it might be to be there, the imagination of what's happening if we're not there might feel worse, even if we completely trust the healthcare team.
Yes.
So I think it is a little more complex on the parent side.
Yes.
But I think the preponderance of the evidence and what feels better to most parents and what actually works well for the healthcare team too, once they're used to it, is to have parents present when possible. But again, really giving permission to that parent who just for whatever reason isn't able to be there. And so healthcare providers need to be good at quickly making that that decision. It is, in the end, of course, anything that puts the life-saving medical care at risk, that has to come first, of course.
Right.
And I think when we think of what we'd like providers to do, it's not for every nurse or every physician to become a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker. It's that just in the course of doing their own job, they are aware of traumatic stress and aware of how this might be impacting kids and parents and make some simple shifts in things like this, again, that are often happening already, and involve and support parents, remembering that child's perspective. You know, we've come up with a simple tool that seems to resonate for healthcare teams because often, again, in the midst of a busy medical practice, you need something quick to remember. And we talk about after the ABCs, you know, after the basics or after airway, breathing, circulation, the first things, then think about DEF.
Let's talk about DEF.
Distress, emotional support, and the family.
Okay, and what's the difference between distress and emotional support?
Well, distress is remembering, as we're talking about pain and fears and worries, and what's this child going through, both on the emotional and the physical side.
Yep.
Emotional support is thinking about what this patient or this child needs in terms of the supports that are there for them, who's there to provide emotional support for them.
Yep.
How do we support their parent in doing that, or how do we do that if there's not someone else around? And then the F for family is just to remember everybody else, to remember the parents, and help them to deal with their own reactions to what's going on.
Remembering DEF for distress, emotional support, and family can help providers at any level address the psychosocial needs of patients, both young and old, since children are not the only ones at risk of developing traumatic stress reactions after medical experiences. Nancy Andrews, our next guest, describes how she developed PTSD after spending time in an intensive care unit with life-threatening illness. Post-ICU PTSD is becoming increasingly recognized as a serious complication of critical illness. Here's Nancy's story.
Nancy Evelyn Andrews lives on the coast of Maine, where she makes films, drawings, props, and objects. She works in hybrid forms, combining storytelling, documentary, animation, puppetry, and research. She's been the recipient of numerous grants and fellowships, including the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, the LEF New England Moving Image Fund, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Six of Nancy's films are in the film collection at the Museum of Modern Art, and one is at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago film collection. Nancy studied at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and received a Master of Fine Arts there in 1995. Nancy Andrews is currently on the faculty of the College of the Atlantic, where she teaches video making, animation, time-based arts, and film studies. Welcome to Safe Space, Nancy.
Thank you, Anne.
So I know you were in the ICU for a long time. Tell me what brought you to there. How come you were a patient to start out with?
I have a condition that causes a weakening of the arteries, and I had an aneurysm that was being followed, and then it started to tear, and I was in Bar Harbor and eventually got life-flighted to Boston, where I had multiple surgeries and was in the surgical intensive care unit for a couple of weeks and in the hospital for nearly a month.
And during that time, I understand that you became delirious, and I wondered if you could just describe what that means in the context of the ICU.
Well, it's super common for this to happen, and probably if people have had friends or family in the ICU, they may have seen this, but people who are in the ICU are experiencing like a lot of drugs and a lot of sleep deprivation and pain management and all of this stuff and trauma because you're really sick. And the result of that sometimes is you're not in touch with the same reality as everybody else. So you're having hallucinations, and for some reason, often these turn really ugly and paranoid.
And
so
I know
you might, a lot of it's very common for people to think that the medical staff is somehow wanting to harm them or something like that, or see weird things on the walls or et cetera.
And my understanding is that, in fact, it's almost more the norm. It's the exception almost not to get delirious in the ICU, that the combination of very severe, you know, very heavy-duty pain medications as well as sedation, because so many patients are, of course, on mechanical ventilators.
Yeah.
And the combination of sort of the lights being on all the time and no, the sleep-wake cycle being so off and no movement.
Yeah.
That it's sort of like a perfect storm for people to really lose touch with what's real and what's not real.
Yeah, exactly.
In my reading about it, preparing for this interview, Nancy, I was struck that it's really being, delirium is now being referred to as an acute brain injury.
And right, that, which means I think that it's not the kind of brain injury that necessarily would be long-lasting, but it is interesting that that's one of the definitions of delirium, but there are long-term effects from it for a lot of people that include cognitive and psychological problems. So
I want to wait to talk about the psychological problems for a minute, but cognitively, did you feel that your own thinking was less sharp afterward?
Well, it took me quite a long time to just get over the experience, even though I didn't believe that people were out to get me. It still was really unclear to me that they hadn't been at some time during the experience. But also, for example, months later, I was a guest at a film seminar, and after the screening, there was a question and answer period, which, as a filmmaker, that's par for the course. I'm used to that. I'm usually really pretty good at them. And I couldn't understand the questions. I had to keep saying, could you rephrase that? And it was almost impossible for me to answer them.
And you're a film teacher.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Is that something that's persisted? I know this is 6 years ago now or more. Do you feel like that is completely gone at this point?
You know, I don't know, because I just turned 50, and so people also tell me that there's
right.
other effects of aging. But my students laugh at me some days because I'm thinking it's Tuesday when it's Monday, or you know, so who knows why exactly? But
right, and I want to just pause here for a second to just explain the extent of this problem, because what I understand is that about 5 million. People in the U.S. are in the ICU in a given year, and about one-third of those people may suffer from delirium. So we're talking about a very common problem.
Right. I mean, I'm not even sure if that number is the one-third suffer from delirium or one-third suffer from problems that come out of delirium.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And when you say that, what do you mean by problems that come
out
of delirium?
Well, I mean the cognitive problems, and I mean the psychological problems of depression and PTSD symptoms, those kinds of things.
Yeah. So let's talk now about the psychological aspect of this. We know that what PTSD means, post-traumatic stress disorder, is the fallout to an experience of overwhelming helplessness, where there may be a very real threatened loss of life. We often associate it with war or combat. We associate it with rape or sexual assault. And really, the thought that medical treatment could be the cause of PTSD is not yet in the public consciousness, although that's changing. And of course, your film
is part of that. But tell me how PTSD manifested itself in you.
Well, for me, and it's ongoing. I mean, it's way better now than it was, but when it started, I hadn't been home from the hospital all that long. And they, you know, people don't really diagnose it as PTSD until you're a month out from the traumatic event. Anyway, so before that, it's acute PTSD, I guess. But I would just have this weird feeling like I was back in the feeling of being in the ICU. And I couldn't articulate it very well. And I called my doctor here in Bar Harbor, and I told him what was happening. And he said, look, I've known you for a while. You know, I just want you to trust me on this. I want you to go see a psychiatrist. I think you might have PTSD. So I was super lucky that he recognized, like I said, I wasn't that articulate, and I didn't even know. In fact, the movie, I thought it was like The Deer Hunter, because mm-hmm. I was kind of experiencing, I think they show flashbacks in that, but I wasn't even able to language that I was having a flashback at that point.
Right, so you really were lucky because you had a doctor who got it.
Yeah.
Who got it and got you to help quickly, which yeah. I can imagine is not the norm, sadly.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, from what I understand, it's something that you want to get treated sooner than later. You know, the best results typically are if people try to get treated as, you know, earlier. Mm-hmm.
So you said, when I asked you about it, you said, well, it's ongoing. And so what I get is that immediately you felt like you were sort of reliving it. You were having these flashbacks. How does it manifest now?
Well, nightmares have been, you know, persistent. So this was 6 years ago, and I still have nightmares, but the frequency is way reduced. And, you know, I've been getting help for, you know, every week for 6 years. So, it used to be a couple times a week that I would have, you know, terrible nightmares and wake up in a panic. And now it's maybe once or twice a month. Kind of interrupted sleep is fairly common. And then I still, like, because I'm a filmmaker and I like to watch films, I have sometimes get triggers from that. And for instance, I went to see Safe House, and you know, about 10 minutes in, they strap him in a chair. And because I was restrained at different points in the ICU, like when someone gets restrained in a movie, you know, in any form of torture, I just have to leave the theater, at least until the scene's over. But with that one, I just, you know, decided that I couldn't really handle the movie, so...
Mm-hmm. And of course, it makes complete sense because I presume you were restrained in the ICU.
Yeah, absolutely.
And which is a very common...
Because I was hallucinating, I was combative because I wanted to get out of the bed. I wanted to get the heck out of there. And so they had to restrain me so that I wouldn't hurt myself by climbing out of the bed when I really didn't have the strength to walk or stand, you know. And I was hooked to all this machinery, so.
I want to just read you. You've written this very powerful essay about your experience on your website, nancyandrews.net. I want to just read a few segments of it about this because they were very compelling to me. And it jumps around a little, but you are trying to save my life, but it feels like you are trying to kill me. If I had one word to sum up my ICU experience, it would be, quote-unquote, horror. In reality, the ICU is a torture chamber. If you take away the knowledge that everyone is trying to keep you alive, what is actually happening can be pretty dreadful. Being on a ventilator is a nightmare, and your ability to communicate by speaking is taken away. If you are agitated, you will be restrained so that you stay in bed and don't hurt or kill yourself. And you are probably in pain from a traumatic event or serious illness to begin with. And it goes on. I'm going to stop there. It makes sense to me that seeing scenes of torture or being tied down are just intolerable because, in fact, you did while they were trying to save your life, it really was an experience of torture in many ways.
Right. And then when you really aren't functioning well, I felt like, and I even wrote this at some point during my ICU stay, I thought they had removed 7/8 of my brain, because that's what it, I don't know why I came up with that number, but that's what it felt like to me, because my thinking was so confused and clouded and all of that. So you're trying to figure out what's going on, but you can't really. So, you know, for all I knew, I was in a place of torture, and a lot of my hallucinations, you know, that was what was happening. So I wasn't in a hospital. I was in a deep well, as if it was Silence of the Lambs, or I was, being abused by some terrible parental figure or something like that.
It's very, if I try to imagine myself in your position in that ICU bed, tied down, not trusting that they haven't taken out my brain, I can't think straight. You were on a mechanical ventilator for some period of that time, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So you can't even speak or call for help.
And then, of course, after they, because I'd been on it for a while, and then they, when I was off of it, it had damaged one of my vocal cords, so I couldn't speak above like a bare whisper. And I remember trying to, you know, get help at one day, and it was just so pitiful. It was like whispering help, you know. So it's a very helpless feeling.
One of the experiences that so many people who suffer from trauma report later is a feeling of shame that goes with PTSD.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, did you suffer from shame about this?
Well, I still think I on occasion feel like I must be a weak person, that I have this, you know, trouble getting over this experience. And I know that that's totally irrational, but, you know, to this day, I have moments where I feel that way.
I think that that's almost universal in my experience as a clinician with trauma, that people blame themselves for the event to begin with, or for their inability to heal from it in the way they wish, or that their friends wish they would get over it.
Right.
It almost seems to be one of the defining hallmarks of PTSD, is this aspect of shame. So I want to talk to you about your art and about the film in a minute, but I want to ask you one last question about the PTSD part first.
Sure.
Which is, when you say, you know, you talk about this pressure to forget, to move on and forget. But the question of memory and trauma is one that has been such a source of controversy in our culture as a whole. But it's also a very profound experience for each person, you know, how trauma affects our memory. Mm-hmm. And you write very powerfully about these sort of unconscious memories. And I wondered if you could tell me a story that captures what your experience is of memories that you don't remember you have.
Well, I'm kind of the belief now, or I am of the belief now, that we remember a great deal more in some way than you would think is possible. For example, one thing that happened to me was that in our town, we have this day called Pajama Day, and everybody comes out, and it's early morning shopping specials. And afterwards, I was having breakfast in this very noisy restaurant. You've got the clattering and the silverware, et cetera, and people are dressed in pajamas. Well, I look down, and someone walks by in their pajama pants with clogs on. And at that moment, I just had to get out of that restaurant. And to me, that says that, you know, I could remember the operating room, you know, because I imagine it's a fairly noisy, busy place, and there's people wearing scrubs with clogs on, because clogs are like the regular thing that surgeons wear in the operating room.
It's almost a uniform.
There's been studies done at New York Presbyterian Hospital that did a study where they played word pairs over the speakers in the OR to unconscious patients, right, who are having surgery. And it was a double-blind type of study. So then people went around and read the word pairs to the patients after they were recovering, and they didn't know who had heard them and who hadn't heard the word pears. And the people that had heard them were able to, they'd say the word and they would say the other word in the pear. Now they were, you know, under sedation, right?
Right. There are a number of studies that show that people can hear and remember what is said throughout an entire operation under which they're under a general anesthesia, which is, of course, a very terrifying thought.
We continue our discussion of shame and medical trauma by looking at the use of restraint in another medical setting, psychiatric hospitals. We'll hear how the use of restraints can lead to shame and trauma for both the individuals being restrained and for those putting patients into restraints.
Today, I'll be speaking with Bob Staines of the Public Conversations Project about his work facilitating a dialogue between patients who had been restrained when they were in psychiatric units at a hospital and the people who were responsible for doing those restraints. Put in more general terms, this is an example of how do you talk to the people who you feel have hurt you? How do you dare trust them to listen to you and understand? And also, how do you find it in yourself to listen to them? Bob Staines is the Senior Vice President of the Public Conversations Project, working to facilitate constructive dialogue among opponents on issues of sexual orientation, religion, gender, abortion, social class, and race. He consults at Harvard Law School, he's on the board of directors of the Democracy Imperative, and he also has a private mediation, training, and consulting practice in Danvers, Massachusetts. Of note, Bob was the former director of training for a state mental hospital himself, where they required all new staff to have the experience of being put into restraints so they could get a feel for what that experience was like. Welcome to Safe Space, Bob.
Thanks, Anne. It's great to be with you.
So, Bob, let's start out by defining our terms. What do we mean when we say restraints and seclusion? What are we talking about?
Okay, well, when someone is restrained, generally speaking, there are four staff people involved. Each person takes a limb and applies a leather wristlet or anklet and puts that person down on a bed and ties those wristlets and anklets to the sides of the bed. And seclusion is when someone is put in a room that has nothing in it usually, but except for perhaps a mattress, and locks the door or closes the door so that the person can't leave, and keeps an eye on the person to make sure they don't hurt themselves.
So it's like a form of solitary confinement, briefly,
yes.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that this dialogue was prompted because the federal government gave out some grants to try to eliminate the use of restraints and seclusion. And why are they a problem? I mean, it seems like it might be obvious, but why was the federal government interested in reducing this?
Well, the government had commissioned a number of studies back in the 1990s, which demonstrated some of the dangers, more the physical dangers of restraint and seclusion, that people were getting injured, both patients and staff, and also the emotional danger of traumatization or re-traumatization of people who had been through difficult times in their lives already. So it was in everybody's best interest, really, to try to reduce or provide alternatives to these forms of I don't know if I would call them treatment, but management would be a better term.
So I understand that the Department of Mental Health in Massachusetts got this grant to try to reduce this, and that part of the mandate was to involve patients and families and staff in dialogue, in sort of constructing the solutions together. And my understanding is that they tried to do this. They tried to have these dialogues, and it didn't work, and that you and the Public Conversations Project got called in to try to help. What made it difficult to talk about these things?
Well, if I could just say a little bit about the project, just in terms of the language that you just used.
Yeah.
Because they were actually constituted as a work group.
Okay.
And part of the problem was that there was not a space for dialogue.
Oh.
There was not a space to really have a personal conversation about how people were affected by these techniques. And I'd just also say that it wasn't folks that were directly involved applying seclusion and restraint to the people that received them. We didn't bring those folks together, but folks who had experienced it on both ends.
I see. Yes, they weren't involved in the same exact restraint.
Right,
but
exactly.
Both, yes, I see.
The reason that, I think you asked about the reason that we were called in.
Yeah.
Yeah. The group had been working well together when it came to dealing with the specifics of policy and assessment. But when it came time to go further and talk personally about their passions and feelings, that's where it became very difficult. And because people on both sides of that had had contact with public conversations, they thought that we might be able to create the environment where it would be possible to talk about these things.
And so I'd love to ask you to tell me a little bit more specifically about what made it hard, and maybe we'll take each side one at a time. If we take the people who had been formerly hospitalized, mm-hmm. who were, you know, the psychiatric patients who had been restrained, what made it hard for them to talk about, and how did you help them with that?
Well, if you can imagine what it would be like to have a group of people surround you and take your limbs and tie them to a bed, it's a terrifying experience. And it's an experience that no one would want to relive nor talk about. And to do so would make people very vulnerable to feeling those feelings of fear and trauma all over again. So that was, I think, part of what was at stake for people on the receiving end. People on the staff end, it's also a very difficult and traumatizing experience to have to exert that kind of force over another person. And many people that have been involved in those situations would much rather forget them and not talk about them as well.
I can imagine, you know, from the standpoint of the person doing the restraining, that that person is working in that kind of unit because they want to help. And that to treat someone like that, to force them against their will, to tie them down while they're protesting. I've witnessed restraints myself, and they feel ugly and awful and desperate, I think, for everybody involved. But also frightening for the staff, not only for the patient. Did people speak to that?
You know, I can't say what people actually spoke about in the dialogue itself.
Okay.
But I can tell you from my other work and experience that you mentioned in the state hospital and in other psychiatric facilities that people on the staff side have spoken often about how difficult it was and how frightening it was and how they carry feelings away with them of fear and guilt as a result of participating.
So I can imagine for them to listen to what it was like might be very painful, because it might reinforce, the risk would be that it might reinforce that feeling of guilt.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I understand that confidentiality is a big part of how you kept it safe. So I want mm-hmm. to respect that, Bob. Mm-hmm. But I also know that you have years of experience with this in other contexts. And I'd love to ask you, were there things that you learned? I think I'm going to take both sides here, too. Were there things that you learned about the experience of restraint, of being restrained, that you hadn't appreciated before you did this?
You know, I have to say, I don't think there was much that really changed for me, because in our training program, when I worked in the state hospital, we did a lot of work on this, and we actually had patients come in and speak with staff about their experience. So it's something that I've been involved in for many years.
Well, let me rephrase my question then.
Sure.
So, because you, right, so you had already opened your heart to hearing about this way before
yeah.
these dialogues. So let me ask you about that instead, which is, when you did that, when you listened to people speak about it beforehand as the training mm-hmm. director, or when you were in restraints yourself as part of the training you went through, mm-hmm. were there surprises for you that for me, not having had that experience, I might not know, or I might not anticipate?
I think the surprise was the amount of terror I felt just as a trainee, having to be in restraint for 10 minutes. And to imagine what it would be like to be in that condition for hours was a real eye-opener for me.
Of course, what we know is that the majority of people who are psychiatrically hospitalized have trauma histories already. So I can imagine that you're taking someone who's already been rendered helpless previous to it, and then you're tying them down, and there's really a form of re-traumatization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you're actually bringing up something that does prompt me to speak about surprise. My surprise, I think, is in the courage and resilience of people who are willing to talk about this, who are willing to talk with each other about it. And it's something that frequently happens in our dialogue work. But the courage that people showed in having these dialogues was especially poignant.
But I am curious. I would like to ask you about your story, especially as a way to honor, you know, that we can only tell our own stories. How you think now in retrospect, because this is some time ago, how do you feel that your own experience, having been one to put people under strain, did you worry that it impacted your ability to do that job? Did it, in fact, help you do that job because you had such a visceral sense of it? How was that for you?
I think it did help me. And not just because I had been on the sort of giving end of that, but because of my work after that as a training director in a state mental hospital, working with people who were actually hospitalized at the time, and working with folks who were survivors of that system to create training for people that was going to emphasize the lived experience of people on the receiving end of that. I think all of that has figured into this, certainly the project that I was involved in, but also a lifelong passion around this issue and around other issues in terms of how people with serious mental illness are treated in our country.
So let me ask you something. I want to come back to the thing you said before about comparing people's pain, because I just had this other thought about it I want to run by you, which is that there is a fundamental difference in power. You know, that the one who's doing it can leave the room when it's done. There's something about acknowledging that the one who was restrained was in a profoundly disempowered, vulnerable position, and that the other person, no matter how devastating it was, and no doubt it was, to be in that role, there is nonetheless a huge inequality in terms of vulnerability and power. And that would probably be important to me to have that be acknowledged. I'd love to hear how you feel about that.
Well, I can certainly understand that and know that that's the case. I think this is where we get into talking about what our role is as dialogue designers and facilitators. So I'm not saying that people shouldn't compare their own pain with the pain of another, but it's their business. It's not my business to do that for them. One of the things I learned from a terrific woman who's a national leader in consumer survivor work is Patricia Deegan. And I met Pat back in the 80s. She was really responsible for opening my mind to a lot of things. And back then she said, you know, you as clinicians have progressed from doing to us to doing for us, and the next step is to do with us. And I feel that what we do at Public Conversations is create the environment where people can bear witness to their own stories without our interference of trying to shape them in some way. So if people want to talk about the difference in the balance of power, it's our job to make that possible. And that is, in fact, you know, what we do quite often. But, you know, one of the interesting things is when you get to talking about that, you really get into conversation about power, and people start to discover all kinds of ways that it affects people in different situations. So in a hospital, for instance, you know, obviously if you're there against your will and you can't get out, that's about as powerless as you can get. But there are a lot of other ways that power is exercised on people at, the lowest level of the staff who will lose their jobs if they don't comply with things that they maybe don't want to do.
And it makes me think, you know, I was a doctor, so I might observe a restraint or have to document it, but I never had to do it because I had power.
And the lowest paid mental health workers were the ones who had to do it. And that's right. And if they had refused, they would have been fired.
Yeah. So that's not to say that there's any, you know, equation of loss of power, but I think if we can create the environment where people can speak to all aspects of that and they can really hear each other, that's success. And it's not up to me to make those determinations.
The opportunity to truly hear each other's stories, as Bob describes, is at the heart of what Safe Space Radio is all about. It's through these courageous conversations that we will continue to address the shame, humiliation, and trauma that can arise, even when we are working to help and heal others. That concludes this episode of Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on shame and trauma in the medical encounter. Please fill out the few quick questions on the website that will give you credit for listening and help to solidify some of the most important clinical takeaways. We'd be grateful, too, for your feedback about this show. Your responses will help us measure the impact of hearing stories from the people who know these struggles from the inside. Thank you to the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation for their support of this project, our guests, our producers Gabe Graben and Caitlin Swaljay, and our education coordinator, Sarah Powers. I'm Dr. Ann Hallward, and I invite you to check out the rest of our archive devoted to telling authentic and inspiring stories about the things we would struggle with less if we could talk about them more.